We're going to be discussing, as it's titled, Plant Anger, Grow a Fool. In fact, you could almost say that anger is fool seed. What we want to do is examine this from the perspective of Old Testament examples, beginning with the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon, in his book of Proverbs, talked about a number of contrasts. Some things were more intense forms than the others, but in his contrast, he would measure wisdom against foolishness. And quite frequently, associated with those things that he called foolishness would be the word anger. In Proverbs 3 and 35, Solomon writes, "The wise shall inherit glory, but shame shall be the legacy of fools." And in this passage, he establishes the principle that foolish conduct brings not only shame to the person in the present, but in long term, they will be remembered for their folly. And I want you to remember that principle as we consider the balance of this lesson, the three examples of foolishness that will follow. In 12 and 16, he writes, "A fool's wrath is known at once." Fundamentally, what he's saying here is that it's easy to identify the foolish one by the wrath that he exhibits or the anger that he so willingly demonstrates or shows forth. But he contrasts that by saying, "A prudent man covers his shame." And the implication there is that outbursts of anger are shameful. And so a wise or a prudent individual controls his wrath or his anger so that he doesn't manifest foolishness. And then in 29 and 11, he writes, "A fool vents all of his feelings, but a wise man holds them back." And you can see the progression in each of these three verses, how that he continues to intensify the principle until it is beyond dispute in the last verse of the reading. A fool just lets everybody know what he's thinking and feeling, especially anger. But a wise person holds them back. And I want you to notice that when we conclude this lesson, we will consider this same principle, that we are in control of our feelings. The Bible is a book of examples. In fact, you find embedded in all of the Scriptures both examples that are good for us to follow, examples that are informative and instructive, examples of the righteous that teach us how to go. But then it also uses examples of persons that are not righteous. It uses examples of anger or foolishness or bitterness or poor behavior as warnings to alert us not to engage in the same behavior. The implication is that if we engage in that behavior, we are no better in the same condition as that one. In 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, you see examples talked about in terms of a warning. He writes, "Now all these things happened to them. The antecedent of them is in the context of the people of Israel and the mistakes they made in following the Lord. Happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come." And Paul's simply saying here in the last dispensation, the things that happened in the distant past serve to instruct or admonish or teach us, but teach us in this case not to behave in that manner. So those examples serve as warnings. But then there are other examples that are designed to be beneficial. I think that's Paul's intent in Romans chapter 15 when in verse 4 he writes, "The things that were written before time were written for our learning, that we through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope." And the reason why I think he's referring to good examples here is that in the book of Romans, he uses primarily the example of Abraham, but of other righteous persons to illustrate for us how it is that we can imitate their examples and benefit from the same kind of approval that God gave the righteous in the past. In fact, I think that when Paul in a shorter way says, "Imitate me as I also imitate Christ," helps us to understand exactly how to apply these examples. That the ones that are given as warnings, we don't want to do that sort of thing. But the ones that are given to us for instruction, we want to imitate those behaviors. And so he says, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. If Paul's following Christ's example, then he's setting the kind of example that we can follow. Tonight we're going to consider the example of three persons. Three persons whose examples serve to us as warning. And in the context of a lesson of anger making one foolish, we'll look at these three persons as warnings to us not to engage or allow anger to lead us to engage in those behaviors. The first one is that of Ahithophel. Ahithophel is one whose anger led to his own personal destruction, and that's what anger can do. Ahithophel is an interesting fellow. He is talked about quite a bit, especially during the time of King David. But Ahithophel has one of those names. It took me years to learn to pronounce that, by the way. Haven't run into too many Ahithophels these days. But at any rate, he was someone who was known for his sage counsel, his wise advice. David used him as a counselor. In fact, he was a counselor during the time of David's rule. But it came to pass that Ahithophel decides that he's going to work with David's son Absalom and give him counsel. And thus you see him beginning to go over to Absalom's side, beginning in verse 12, and he revisits it again in verse 31 of 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel 15. But here you find this wise man is sought out by Absalom, who's trying to build a revolution, essentially, against his father. He wants to take his father's throne prematurely instead of waiting for the proper succession. So Ahithophel begins to advise him. In fact, the word comes to David that this fellow has become involved in the conspiracy of Absalom against his own father. Now, that kind of thing would tend to anger us, wouldn't it? I mean, for us to have a trusted counselor who has decided to go over and render counsel to someone who has the potential to do us harm or someone who is an enemy. But David doesn't seem to become upset by this. In fact, the text that you see on the chart, as they unfold, David tells him to go and be the kind of counselor for Absalom that you were for me. And I thought, wow, that is very big-hearted of David in this particular case. He is showing such a manifestation of good character here that he's not going to get upset or angry that Ahithophel is doing this. So that's what happens. Ahithophel becomes the advisor to Absalom. Now, there is a particular strategic effort on the part of Absalom against his father. And two advisors speak to him. Ahithophel, of whom the text tells us that his advice was so good that it was near to that of inspired prophets. You know, who else does the Scripture say that of? You know, no one in Scripture was wiser than him, save perhaps Solomon. But at any rate, this good counselor that we see in this man, he is offering Absalom some advice for this one initiative that he wants to undertake. There's a fellow by the name of Hushai. Hushai comes along and he has some advice for Absalom to follow. And he offers his advice. And it's discussed. And it seems that they're going to take Hushai's advice over the advice of Ahithophel. And when that happens, toward the end of the 17th chapter, when you're near verse 23, Ahithophel is so upset that Absalom, who is taking the advice of Hushai instead of his own advice, he goes home to his house and hangs himself because he's so angry about this. He goes home and hangs himself. It almost boggles the mind to see someone who is so angry that he would destroy himself, but that's exactly what this fellow did. He gave himself some bad advice, deserted David, and then follows Absalom in his rebellion. But then when his own advice is sought and rejected, he goes home and kills himself. And what this does to for me, at least, is it illuminates the idea that persons who become so angry over such things often become self-destructive. Now, not everyone goes out and hangs themselves or commits suicide when they're angry. But here is a fellow who let anger overwhelm him to the point that he kills himself, that he takes his own life. Now, there is a take-home lesson from this, and that is that professed disciples can become self-destructive in anger. The question is, do some Christians overreact when things don't go the way they should? And the answer to that is yes. Sometimes speaking in ways that are self-destructive. In their anger, saying such things that bring harm to themselves and not just to others to whom they may intend harm. What we take home from this is that anger out of control can destroy our influence for Christ. More specifically, do some members of the church ever hurt themselves in making a point? We live in a time of boycotts, and I've often been amused by them over the years. It's one of the most ineffective ways to get your message across. If anyone remembers the attempted boycott by the left against Chick-fil-A, their business boomed as a result. And the same thing happened with Hobby Lobby. Persons who were rather immoral in their approach, deciding they're going to boycott these places because of some of their moral choices, ended up helping them. The point I'm making is that some disciples will become angry with something that takes place in the local congregation, that which is not related to doctrinal matters, and become angry and leave the faith. Or become angry and refuse to assemble with the disciples. This to me is the New Testament equivalent of Ahithophel's behavior in the Old Testament. He's not getting his way, and no one's listening to his advice, so he's going to go home and destroy himself. And thus it happens to disciples when they don't get their way in the local congregation, decide that they're going to leave the church or leave the faith, the place where they can find a healthy resolution to the problem, instead go home and commit spiritual suicide. It's absolute foolishness. Anger, in this case, leads to self-destruction. The next fellow I want to talk about is Nabal. Nabal, we will come across him, of course, in the book of 1 Samuel, the 25th chapter. Now, we understand that this is a time when David is opposed to Saul, but David is being pursued, and he's living out in the country, sometimes in the mountainous regions. But on this occasion, he and his soldiers, about 600 of them, are camped near a fellow by the name of Nabal. Nabal's affluent, and he has large, extensive flocks. And about the time of the shearing, his shearers and shepherds go out to the pastures, and they're taking the sheep and shearing them. David and his soldiers are camped nearby. Nabal benefits from the nearness of such a large military group, insomuch that no one comes in and bothers his shearers or his shepherds during this time when they're all very busy with the sheep. No one's coming in to steal sheep or do any harm to the shearers or steal the wool once it's been cut. Nabal benefited from the proximity of David's militia. Now, David's people are starting to get a little low on supplies, so they send a message to Nabal asking for a little bit of help in this matter. 25th chapter, beginning at verse 5, David sent 10 young men and said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name." Just talk to the fellow courteously. "And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, 'Peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace for all that you have.'" This is a noble greeting. This is a way to initiate a good dialogue and a good relationship. David's not making demands. He's not a bandit out in the wilderness trying to steal from Nabal. He's trying to make overtures of peace to him. And says, "Ask your young men, and they will tell you, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give us whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David." Now, it is near the feast time, and what David is essentially asking is, "Nabal, I know you're going to have extras because this is a feast day. Just reach over and take some stuff, whatever comes to your hand, it doesn't need to be the best. Reach over and take some stuff and give it to my young men to bring back to supply the soldiers. It's a reasonable request. It's done so in a courteous manner. Let's look at Nabal's response to this. Verse 10. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse?" You know, I don't know this guy. In fact, what I know of him is that he has abandoned his master, Saul. You know, he once served Saul, but he's abandoned him. He's nothing more than a runaway servant. I'm not giving him anything. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I should have killed from my shearers? There's a lot of mice in there, isn't there? And give them to men when I do not know where they are from? In his anger, he's being dishonest. You know what? That's his bread, that's his water, that's his sheep, that's his shearers. Because David's army was camped nearby when they were vulnerable. That's his first mistake. And his second mistake was to say, I don't know who these guys are or where they come from. He knew exactly who David was. And he knew exactly who David's men were because he benefited from their proximity during shearing. This guy in his anger is not only acting the fool, he's distorting the facts. And this is going to lead to Nabal's dishonor. So David's young men return and they give him a report of Nabal's response to them. And David says, strap on your swords. We're going for Nabal. We're going to teach him a lesson. Now, a report of this came from Nabal's own servants to Abigail, his wife. And Abigail realizes that her husband has acted the fool. In being upset, he has shown dishonor, not only to himself, but to all of his household. And so she arranges for a food offering to be put together for all of David's soldiers and sends it on ahead and intends to follow to make explanation. But you will notice in verse 17 how Nabal is described for his foolish anger. Now therefore know and consider what you do, for harm is determined against our master, her husband. She's telling the servants, harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that one cannot speak to him. His own wife is calling him a scoundrel to the servants. I think one of the other translations renders it a churlish fellow. She's not saying nice things about Nabal. Not only is his anger making him a fool, it has brought dishonor to that whole house because of that. And so Abigail takes all of this food and she goes over and she makes a petition to David. Reduces David's anger in this case, and they're able to move on. What was wrong with Nabal? He began with the premise that he was right and David was wrong. Now, I'm not going to play the psychologist here and analyze what goes on in the mind of someone like this, but suffice it to say that Nabal considered his own truth at threat against what he perceived others' truths to be. In other words, Nabal said, I'm right, and everyone else is wrong. And like so many such persons, became angry whenever his own viewpoint was called into question. He began with the premise that he was right and David was wrong. And that's usually the formula for a lot of foolishly angry behavior. The fact is that some believe that their concept of what is fair and what is right is the only correct way. I will suggest to you, brethren, that what is fair and right is defined only in this book and is not modified or changed by our opinions or viewpoints of it. Fair and rightness has been defined by God. And the bottom line here is that we're not the only ones that have a handle on interpreting that. Secondly, Such ones like Nabal insist on their own way, and anyone who disagrees is wrong and therefore becomes the object of their anger. Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Who is this guy? Who are these soldiers? They became the object of Nabal's anger and thus treat dishonorably those who have earned their respect. And that's exactly what David did when he approached Nabal through his young emissaries. He was showing this man courtesy and respect, and it was treated with disrespect. And thus, by dishonoring others temporarily, they do damage to their own honor long term. In refusing to show respect and gratitude to David for the protection and leadership he provided, he made himself a fool. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, we find the instructions given in the New Testament that regardless of what our viewpoint is on what might be fair and right, we are responsible to be subject to those who are placed in positions of leadership. In 1 Thessalonians, we learn that it's those who are elders. We urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves. The esteem and regard that one has for leaders, recognizing that what makes them leaders is biblical qualification, leads such a one to yield their own viewpoint in respect for those who are the leaders. Why does Paul tell them to do this? So that you will be at peace among yourselves. In fact, he goes on to tell Timothy in 1 Timothy 5 and 19, do not receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses. This is done to prevent an individual from becoming angry and lashing out and becoming the source of disruption in a local congregation. But the Lord doesn't limit it to the local church. His principle that one regard and respect those that are their leaders extends into the home. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Their leadership is to be regarded, and those who are under their authority yield their own viewpoint to those who have been appointed by God to be their leaders. In fact, God extended this beyond the local church and beyond the family into the community. When in 1 Peter 2 and 17, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Nabal didn't get it. His anger led him to dishonor. And the third and last one that we will consider is that of Sanballat. If you come with me over to the book of Nehemiah, the fourth chapter, let's build a little background picture here. The children of Judah were in a rather tough place. First of all, they had been exiled to the east for a number of years. For what you would consider a lifetime, minimum of 70 years, some of them possibly longer than that, gathered up in the first and second raid. So we're talking about persons have been away from home for a long, long time. Now they get to go home and they return to Jerusalem, a city whose walls have been essentially torn down. There are large gaps in the wall. And the city itself has been partially burned and clearly looted. And there's just a limited number of ragtag persons left behind. There's not much to come home to. But they come home, and under Nehemiah's leadership and Ezra's spiritual guidance, these people begin the process of rebuilding their city. It is a long task they have before them. And as you see at the end of chapter 2 and all the way through chapter 3, these persons put their hands to the work enthusiastically. But the adversary is not going to be done with them. He stirs up a couple of petty city-state kings from nearby, fellows by the name of Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, as well as those who are with them. The adversary stirs them up to try to hinder the rebuilding of the walls of the city and the restoration of the place. He stirs up people who are moved and motivated by anger. And look at the mistakes they made. Chapter 4, verse 1. But so it happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? He's speaking derisively here in his anger of the efforts of the people of God in trying to restore the city of Jerusalem. His anger catches the attention of others. Not only does he act and talk like a fool from his anger, but his anger draws in some other fools. You know, that doesn't surprise us, does it? His anger draws in some other fools. Now, Tobiah the Ammonite, in verse 3, was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, even if a fox climbs up on it, he will break down their stone wall. He's mocking the Jews. He's joined in with Sanballat's anger. So not only do we have a man who's a leader acting like a fool, he draws in others to him by his anger and foolishness. In fact, it leads him to act the fool. Now, what Nehemiah's response to all this was, instead of lashing out at Sanballat in kind, he says, or he decides he's going to pray. So we see in verse 4, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity. Do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders. There are several things in this passage that amuse me at some level. One of the things that amuses me is that these are fellows who thought they were really something. They're essentially forgotten except for one thing. History will remember from the time of Nehemiah until Judgment Day that Sanballat acted a fool in his anger. That's how he's going to be remembered. So it appears to me, secondly, that the prayer of Nehemiah has been answered by the Lord. You know, there were a lot of other people who misbehaved and acted around the children of Israel that aren't recorded in the Scriptures. But God saw to it that Nehemiah was inspired to write down the foolish behavior of this Sanballat, motivated by his anger. So they start acting foolish now that their anger is not mollified. In verse 7, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. And I guess what you see from implications later in the passage, that these fellows talked to everybody about their plans. Because the word came to the children of Israel, or children of Judah who were living at the outskirts of the city, what was being planned by these fellows in their camps around the city. And so it is, they've made their foolish threats, and their foolish threats were reported. In the 12th verse of the reading, so it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. It strikes me here that Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem were doing a lot of bragging about what they were going to do against the children of Israel. We're going to go surround them, and we're going to attack them on all sides, and we're going to destroy these people. Yammer, yammer, yammer. So much that 10 times it was reported to Nehemiah that this was what was said. Sounds like they're doing a lot of big talk. A lot of boasting. Anger makes them a fool. I used this illustration a little over an hour ago. If you've read Mark Twain's books, and I'm sure a number of you have, most have probably read the book Tom Sawyer, but if you've read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it's about a young fellow who is traveling down the Mississippi on a raft with a fellow by the name of Jim. And they stop at this one particular town, and while they're in the town, they see this one guy who's blustering and bombastic and carries on, and he talks big and waves his arm and shouts at people and carries on and brags about who he's going to beat up and who he's going to kill. He's always carrying on, And two bystanders are overheard, one saying to the other, I sure wish he would threaten me, because then I'd know I'd live to be 100. You gotta love that kind of caricature of someone who talks big and brags and boasts in all of his anger. That's Sanballat. He's acting and talking the fool, making a fool's threat, letting his anger lead him to fundamentally stupidity. And then in the 15th verse, he looks like a fool to everyone. Look at what happens here. It happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. Now you've got to see how this unfolds. What happened when the children of Judah learned that these fellows were making these plots and delivering these threats, what they would do? Half of the workmen took the trowels and the stones in their hand and worked on the wall. And the other ones took shields and weapons in their hands and went on patrol guarding them while they were working on the wall. Essentially, what everyone had to do was work double shifts. If you look elsewhere in the book of Nehemiah, you discover that what they were doing is working so hard, they didn't take time to take off their clothes and wash themselves. They just lay down where they were in their clothes and slept. But they worked, and they finished the wall. And Sanballat, in all of his posturing and all of his angry boasting, was seen to be a fool. In verse 15, when the people realized that they managed to finish the wall, nothing happened to them, they went back to work and essentially ignored him. Anger led to his defeat. And part of what we draw from this is that angry people are a danger to themselves and to others who join them in their anger. They're not hurting others, not that much. They certainly made life a little bit difficult for the people of Judah for a short time, but they were better for the experience, and the Lord's work was completed. Angry persons are a danger to themselves. Solomon writes in Proverbs 22 and 24, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Don't associate with him. Don't waste time with them, because you can learn to behave like him and end up destroying yourself. 29 and 22, an angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. And this reveals to us that such a one makes his own life miserable and the lives of others around him miserable, and he builds and lays up transgressions against himself. So we ask ourselves, how is it that we react when angry? I want you not only to hear the statements made in these passages, but the implications that the Lord is making. You know, we understand all things that are Bible authority come from command, example, and divine implication, what God is implying. So let's see the implications. Ecclesiastes 7 and 9. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. And what Solomon wants us to understand there by his inspiration is that we should hesitate to become angry. What's the implication? That we have control over the pace at which we become angry. We're in charge of how quickly, or the pace in which we become angry. In Ephesians 4 and 26, two things are implied about our power over anger. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. What do we see implied here? Be angry and do not sin. We are in charge of how we react and how we behave when we are angry. If someone says, I was angry, I couldn't help myself, nonsense. Paul is telling us in this passage that we can be angry without committing sin. So it tells us that we are in charge of our reactions when we become angry. And the second thing implied in this passage is we're in charge of how long we will remain angry. For him to tell us, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, suggests to us that we have the power to end it at some point. In other words, we have a choice over how long we are going to be angry, in this case, before the sun goes down. Get over it. Get in control of it before the sun goes down. The psalmist writes in 4:4, be angry and do not sin. It's obvious that Paul seems to be quoting from the psalmist here. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. And this gives us some insight into how it is that we can get control over our anger and wrath. Take a moment. He says on your bed here, find a peaceful place. Sit down and think about it. Think about the cause for your anger. Think about, is it justified to be as angry as I have become? Think about how one will react to it, how I'm going to behave as a result. What kinds of things can I do that will be productive versus unproductive responses? Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. Get control over it. But my favorite of all is in the 37th Psalm and verse 8. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. God doesn't give us commands we can't keep. And by giving us this instruction, He's telling us that we have power over that powerful emotion of anger. What we should study at some point in the future is the fact that God has given us power over all of our emotions. But at any rate, cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. You know, that's feeding and watering the anger to make sure it grows. Do not fret. It only causes harm. We have the power not to be a fool, even if we become angry. God has given us control over it. So we take these three examples from the Old Testament and see them as warnings. These examples warn us from the behavior. And in the New Testament application, learn that we have charge over our emotions, specifically of anger, and do not have to yield to it and commit sin.
What is it that the angry person can do to get control of his anger with regard to his spirituality? That's a reasonable question, and it's a question that's clearly answered in the Scriptures. The Lord tells us that we can be angry and not sin. But the Lord also tells us that we can address those sins that were generated by anger we may have indulged in the past. Whatever sin we have committed, and whatever emotion or choice or action generated that particular sin, can be removed if we go from trying to justify it in our minds to realizing that we need to repent of it. You see, the difference between one who persists in sin and one who is forgiven of his sin is the first one is trying to justify it, accept it, trying to reason that it was okay. And the second one realizes that it was wrong and he needs to repudiate it and repent of that sin. We pray that this evening, if you have indulged in sin, that you will have the spirit of the second person, realizing that the only approach to it that's healthy and acceptable before the Lord is to be humble and acknowledge it. But whatever your spiritual needs, we're happy to assist you in them if you come while we stand and sing.